This is Karen Brewster. Today is October 6th, 2018, and I'm here in Skagway, Alaska with Elaine Furbish, and we're doing this interview at the Peniel Mission.
Peniel.
I can't say it right.
Just think of denial.
Oh, okay. Peniel. Mission. For the Klondike Gold Rush Historical Park Oral History Project. And then we'll also be talking about climate change as we go along. So thank you, Elaine, for taking time on this Saturday morning.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So just to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from originally, how you ended up here?
Sure. I'm originally from the South. You might hear a little y'all slip out every now and then. But I've been in Skagway since, I'll preface the whole rest of this with, I'm not the greatest person with dates.
That's okay.
But
we can
I'm
go with
sure,
general decades. Yeah. That's okay.
Oh, and you have Carl's list, so he will have it documented.
Right.
I'll say it was the spring of 99.
Okay.
That's when I hit the ground here.
Okay. Well, yes, I know that you were natural resources manager starting in 99. I do
well,
that
know makes that.
Sense. So there you
okay.
go.
Came
so.
Up with my partner, husband, from Florida. Prior to Florida, we were working at Denali for a few years, so we were somewhat exposed to Alaska already.
Mm-hmm.
And got the job as the, I believe it was called a natural resource specialist at the time, but again, that detail is,
right.
I'm sure, in the records. I was the second one for the park. The fellow before me, I believe, was named Damien something. I never met him. There was a time period lapse between the end of his time and the beginning of my time. And
okay.
in the interim, there was a, I believe, what was her position? Again, Carl is like the gold
mine.
But
if you can remember names, that
gold
helps.
Mine of, yes.
Yeah.
So her name was Claudia Rector. And she essentially, I think, was like a biotech or something. But she kind of held some projects together, perhaps even initiated. It's unclear to me what Damien initiated, what she initiated. But I'm pretty sure one of the major things was a lichen air quality study.
Okay.
And she definitely was involved with making those contacts, getting it up and running, and collecting the first year of data. And so when I came, I collected the second year of data following those protocols, and we produced a report off of it. And it turned out to be maybe one of the more valuable things that the park has kept up with. So let me think.
So let me just step back to what you grew up in.
Where? Oh, Georgia.
Georgia, okay. And then what's your educational background? You're a biologist?
Ah, okay. I have a bachelor's in plant pathology and a master's in marine, estuarine, and environmental sciences. So I was very heavily into the plant habitat realm of ecology. Then, of course, as soon as you start working for the Park Service, you need to broaden out from your academic training.
Mm-hmm.
But so many things are habitat-based, you know, all the animals' distribution is linked to their habitat.
Yes. So. I'm doing a project with an ecologist, and I'm constantly reminded that it's all about habitat, and it's not just about the animals.
Yeah, yeah. So Klondike was great. My partner and I were both long-term parkies, worked in many different parks, met in a park. And had been doing the Park Service shuffle, and just got tired of, we were like, we're not moving every 3, 4, 5 years anymore. Let's find the place to settle down, and Skagway is it.
So what ended up attracting you to enter into employment with the Park Service in the first place?
Ah, okay. Well, I, after getting my bachelor's, I was more agriculture-oriented at that time, having studied plant pathology. Tried to get a job. This would have been like in the early, mid-80s. Got some lucrative offers from pesticide manufacturers to try to push their pesticides, but that wasn't where I was at. And ended up just, you know, trying to find a job, got a job as a research technician with a university unit that was working in a national park. So that got me exposed to that, and then that kept developing more and more involvement with the parks.
And which park was that?
The first one I worked in was Cumberland Island National Seashore off the coast of Georgia.
Okay. So did you go to the University of Georgia?
I started at the University of Georgia for my bachelor's, and I finished it at Cornell in upstate New York.
Okay. Yeah. And so that park unit, you talked, was that a cooperative studies
unit? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. At the University of Georgia, they have a big ecology program there. Dr. Odom was one of the early pioneers. So they have a strong program there, and I was sent down to Cumberland Island to look at the impacts that the exotic horses there were having upon the plant communities.
Uh-huh. And then your master's is from?
University of Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah. I was working at Assateague Island at that point.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Horses keep calling me.
Right. So tell me what it was like when you first started here at Klondike Park.
Well, it was a little strange because they had had their first natural resource person. Everything I say now is hearsay, but apparently there were some problems. And the person perhaps had some sort of personal problems, but then it affected his work environment. So things were not very organized. There was, I guess, leftover tension that, you know, I felt and took me a while to understand. On the other hand, you know, it was a very young program and sort of, aside from a couple of things that had been initiated, kind of wide open to look at. I was very comfortable in the park setting of a small park with an administrative boundary containing very little actual Park Service federal ownership property. The park I came from immediately prior to Klondike was Timucuan in Florida, almost exactly the same situation. So you have this mosaic of federal ownership, different agencies, state ownership, different organizations within the state, private ownership. It's not like a traditional Yellowstone where, like, you have a park boundary and you own everything inside of it.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be very complicated from the management side of things to have all those different landowners.
It's a different perspective for sure. Yeah. It was an opportunity and dove right in, and let's see.
So what kind of projects does the natural resources program do? I mean, you mentioned the lichen air quality study.
That was already initiated, and contacts were made with a lichenologist down in Oregon who was very supportive. What was her name? Linda Geiser, maybe? Another thing, you know, I'm not the greatest with names, so. But these things can be pinned down if they need to be.
Right.
There was a mountain goat project initiated by a guy named Kyle. Again, someone I never met. And it was even less developed. It was basically, you know, try to go to some high elevation overlooks and see what you can see. That sort of petered out because it did not seem to be a priority.
So did these types of projects, does a scientist from outside, like a university or something, come to the park and say, I want to do a study in your park? Or you as the natural resources manager say, oh, you know, I think it would be interesting if we looked at the mountain goat population. Let's go find somebody to do it.
I'm sure that there was more of the informal aspect to it at that time, and prior to my getting there, they did have a resources review where they brought in outside people. That created a document that I can't remember the title of, which gave recommendations for actions and studies, and I feel confident that the lichen air quality, the mountain goat, I'm struggling to remember. There were a couple of other things grew out of that. But in its infancy, especially without a natural resource specialist or manager on board, it was probably at the whim of both interest within the park as well as being able to garner interest from an outside researcher and practicality if you don't have much in the way of staff.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. Yeah. Is there staff here to actually be out doing your own projects, or you become more the project manager and somebody else is out collecting the data?
When I first got here, it was just me, and it was just me that first summer. At that time, the park organization was a chief ranger who had supervision of the natural resources program, the cultural resources program, which included the historian Carl, and the curatorial program, and the law enforcement and trail rangers.
Right.
They had recently, I understand, split off interpretation, and that person had their own chief. So we had a lot of, we were essentially, you know, a division. All of that is a division. And so the sharing of resources and the response to budget constraints would cross those program areas. But there were four permanent positions. I was the natural resource manager, Carl the historian, Tim Steidel is fixing to retire now, but he was the trail ranger at that time. He's now a chief ranger. And the curator, Debbie Sanders. And then there were various, you know, like part-time archaeologists, field tech, that kind of stuff that could come and go. They tapped into the SCA program, too.
The Student Conservation Association?
Yeah, so there was that.
So they would come for summer seasonals?
Yeah. So when I got here, the division chief Reed McCluskey had I got here right at the start of the season, and so really the time to hire summer seasonals was past.
Right.
You know, and he mentioned that, you know, things were kind of in flux and kind of gave me the choice: how much do you want to pursue these things? And I looked at what was going and thought that, you know, that lichen study, 1 year in, one more year of data collection, and then a preliminary report could be written. So it seemed worth investing in. Since I didn't have any staff, I did what any red-blooded natural resource manager would do. It's like I got my husband to help me. And so we got the data collection done. But then the next couple of summers, things were more organized. We had things more identified. The Park Service at that time had PMIS. What a great acronym.
Yes, it's like their grant project database system.
Yeah.
The idea I don't even know what it stands for.
Project Management
Information System. Yeah. I don't know.
We always made jokes about, you know, PMS is a headache. So is this. The concept was lovely. Try to project out 5 years ahead. Try to write at least a few paragraphs on every natural resource project you think you might be interested in doing if the funding could be found. The execution was a little cumbersome with difficulty entering data in a database to, you know, it's one of those things that sounded great, but I don't know what came of it. I don't think it lasted very long.
Well, I mean, but also how easy or difficult is it to project out what you want to do in 5 years? Maybe with natural resources, it's easier.
Well, if you're starting with essentially a blank slate, it was pretty easy to come up with lots of, like, the basic things. We don't know anything about X.
Oh, yeah, there were no baseline studies.
Yeah, yeah. So, and also at about the same time, they got the inventory and monitoring inter-park system was really getting strong. So we got support through the Southeast group, which was Glacier Bay, Sitka, and us, I believe. Well, of course, you know, two tiny little parks right. and then big old Glacier Bay.
Right.
So they were able to give us a lot of input and support that way. So over that first winter, I was able to get some projects up and going. I was able to hire a couple of seasonals, got an SCA the next summer. You know, we started doing more stuff, and it was kind of running along that way, I would say, with typically four positions of summer help, maybe two or three of them paid positions, and broaden the scope of the types of projects and programs going on.
Do you remember what some of those first projects were?
Let's see. It was a long time ago.
I know.
although I will say that as far as documentation goes, one of my pet peeves was documentation. And I would put out something I called a bi-monthly report, which was sent over to the archives. So it's like twice a month, we would sort of summarize, what have we been up to?
Okay.
I having worked in a lot of different parks, and even in the many natural parks where they had been cruising along without any natural resource management, and encountered an awful lot of, why do we need you? What are you doing anyway?
Yeah.
And I got in the habit of doing those bi-monthly reports, like, we really are working.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking here, I was thinking, like, why didn't they have all that baseline information? The park's been here since the late 70s, but it was a historical park, and they were doing artifacts and the buildings, and mm-hmm. the natural resources were probably not anything yeah. they thought was needed.
Yeah, and it's a natural thing, especially when you're getting up and running. But once they were fully established, had done, you know, the lion's work of the historic building restorations and everything, and things were kind of humming along. By the time they said, oh, well, we have natural resources too. And, you know, when I was here, there were many, many, many meetings where it came up again, we're a historical park, why do we need natural resources? The example I would always try to bring up was the one that was at Denali, which is a huge, huge natural resources park. And those meetings, we would have, why do we need cultural resources? We're a big natural park. Mm-hmm. For the same reason, you have significant cultural resources, you need to take care of them. You have significant natural resources, it's very appropriate. But I don't know that bias will ever go away in both directions,
right.
The big natural parks to culture and the big cultural parks to natural. But the more we looked into it, and back to that lichens air quality thing, based on talking to the lichenologist who was contacted to help mm-hmm. with that, and a visit that she came up, and we wandered around for a while, went up towards the pass for the White Pass unit. I don't know that we actually got down to the unit, but we got nearby. And she started, you know how the scientists are, she started oohing on and, oh my gosh, look at this, the biodiversity is amazing. And so we put in the PMIS system, examined the biodiversity of the lichens, and I think right after I left that the person who came after me, Meg Haar, I think she got that accomplished and established that this is one of the little biodiversity hot spots oh. of Alaska as far as that's concerned. And there's evidence also with the the vascular plants, and this has very significant natural resources here, and it's a very worthwhile place for both study and monitoring. A scientific study and monitoring. So, you know, I as far as the region-wide efforts go, and as far as the scientific perspective, you know, trying to attract researchers here and all, I think that over the intervening years that plenty of evidence has been assembled and established to say, yes, we have very significant natural resources.
Cool. And you, so you were in the job until 2001?
Yeah, like that one's easier to remember because we all, you know, I got, we're old enough. Right. I got two of them. I got the Kennedy assassination and I got 9/11. So I referenced things to them. I was after 9/11, so it was in the sometime in late 2001 is when I decided to leave. So is that what you want to talk about too?
Well, we can. I was just thinking like what your tenure at the
park.
At the park. But
yeah,
if you
so what is that? That's about just shy of 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like why did you not stay longer, I guess would be the question.
Yeah. Yeah, as a long-term parkie, they hired the first, they reorganized again, and instead of everything being under the chief ranger position, they decided to have a resources chief, and they hired that person, and her name is Teresa Thibault, and she came on, I think it was that summer. And after a fairly short time, month and a half or so, we realized we were going to have a personality conflict and you know, various, it was a difficult time, various steps were taken. I even went to the superintendent once and said, can we get some counseling, you know, can we need to develop a working relationship? But that... that didn't happen. I tried to get some advice from some people. I came to the conclusion that our personality conflict was such that it would cause more damage for me to try to stay than to go ahead and let somebody else try to do it. And since Mike, my partner, and I had made the decision to stay here, and not move to another park, which is what people would normally do.
Right.
I just resigned. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after that, I tried to be supportive, but not be disruptive. And so the next person who came, Meg, real smart, sweet woman, since I was involved with the new bird club. We had some contact. I was trying to be careful to keep my distance, but trying to remember what the incident was. I think it was like a bird to be put in a freezer to be sent to the museum at UAF. And I was like, I did that, you know, because she was busy with something. And then it got back that Elaine was in the park. And then she got called into the office and told, you know, that was unacceptable, and it caused problems for her. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll just back right off, no problem. Yeah. I didn't have too much involvement, but we would, you know, especially with birds, we would talk about things, and she was wonderful with being involved with the bird club. I would say that now, with Annie and Jamie who just left, that things have become greatly relaxed and that we've been working together more intimately on things. Mm-hmm. And the Bird Club is pretty well established now, so more opportunities for interaction there.
Yeah, so I was wondering with the Bird Club is how much partnering with the Park Service is. When did you find... You started the Bird Club when?
Oh, I didn't start the Bird Club. So when I got here, the curator, Debbie Sanders, and Joanne Byerly, whom you met yesterday, and it might have been Deb Betcher. She was kind of coming and going then because she had a place in Fairbanks. Maybe one other. As a very informal thing, those people in the summertime especially were getting together like once a week on their lunch breaks or, you know, to talk about birds. And that was the start of the Bird Club. And then as things progressed and more people got interested, we started not being just sort of a little park service thing, more of a community thing. We've never been formal. We are not We have no legal status.
You're not an official nonprofit organization.
Right, right. Yet. We're just like a bunch of people interested in birds. And without planning to, I sort of drifted into the organizational role because I organize things. I'm not the best birder in town by a long shot, but I'm the one who organizes information. So mm-hmm. people tend to think, you probably had somebody tell you, oh yeah, Elaine, she runs the bird club or she's the president. And it's not, it's just that I'm the one who organizes things.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So I would struggle to say at what point did it even become, was it maybe about 2002? 2002 is when we started doing the Christmas bird camp. That's probably about the time it really coalesced into a community-based group. Yeah.
Yeah, and so then, yeah, was you mentioned that monitoring program that the Park Service was starting, environmental monitoring. Did they collaborate with the birders in sort of like a citizen science project?
Not really. The first big one that was created by MAG was the Coastal Waterbird Survey. And at the time she created it, it may have been known as the Shorebird Survey, but now it's called the Coastal Waterbird Survey. She had some good technicians, and especially this one guy, what was his name? I want to say Wayne, maybe? Nah. Anyway, she was able to hire some biotechs who were very good birders. And I'm not sure exactly who they worked with to come up with their protocol, but they came up with a protocol and started doing this program. As I already mentioned, there was some tension, and in order to keep Meg's life very calm, we didn't try to be too involved with that. But then as it developed, and especially if there are staffing problems, like there have been times when they have not been able to hire a summer seasonal with birding experience. Oh. And then, so if this person is asked to try to do this, you know, so as much as we could, people would volunteer to help out. And as things, relationships have thawed, things, that just continues more and more. And it's become routine for mm-hmm. some people in the bird club, me included, to help out with that survey every year.
So that's a continuing annual survey, that mm-hmm. shorebird. And is that done in the spring?
It's done in the spring, the summer, and the fall. Oh. It's designed to catch the migration, the spring and fall migrations, and to document, you know, the ones that are around in the summer are usually the breeders. So, and I believe it's part of the INM based, you know, the whole effort to say, all right, the Park Service really lacks baseline, and you always have the problem of shifting baselines. If, you know, a resource is under impact for decades, and then you just start monitoring it here and call that the baseline, well, that is very, very false assumption. Right. That tends to be what happens. But it's better to start as soon as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that whole INM program has been just great. And I believe that this was part of the impetus for this was to start covering your bases that way.
Yeah. So besides the shorebird monitoring, were they monitoring other things? Or are they monitoring other things? Are they continuing to look at the lichen or the...
Oh yeah,
they've got a great
program now. As far as just the birds, even when I was there, there are these big programs. You may have heard of them, breeding bird surveys. It's the United States and Canada. It's huge. I'm sure there are routes in Fairbanks.
I'm sure.
So at that point. The breeding bird survey, somebody was showing up in Skagway at the right time. You're supposed to do it at a certain time in the breeding cycle. And doing this breeding bird survey. And the park didn't even know anything about it. So one of the things that we did was try to get the park more involved with that. And now the park actually kind of coordinates the data collection for that. Since it is a continent-wide program, they're not involved with, you know, the data management or the analysis and reporting and everything, mm-hmm. but they make sure that that route is covered. By the same token, the Alaska Land Bird Monitoring Survey is a statewide effort in a similar vein. They make sure that that data gets collected. It's as simple as, you know, like giving housing to an accomplished expert birder who can do that work. They've done some great work with bat monitoring. Dave Shirokauer had got a lot of stuff going. The amphibians, which is the toads here. A number of plant things, you know. I think we did the first invasive exotic plant species was a little report that we put out when I was there. And then it became the basis for comparison with more. At the time I was there, the GIS program was very, very young, and it was folded under natural resources. And I'll try not to be too technical, but, you know, like the GPS satellite constellation was incomplete and was hard to even use a GPS unit to get a reliable fix on a location back then. I mean, it was very, very young. And so it has been quite developed, and I understand it's still part of natural resources. I'm not the person to give you the best information about where it stands or where it stood at any time during that.
I was thinking about what during your tenure, what kinds of things.
Oh, during my tenure. Yeah. Oh, well, then take all that away because
It was a comment. You're right. We were talking about monitoring and continuing things, but now let's go back to your tenure.
When I was there.
The things you did.
Yeah, or arranged to have done.
Yeah.
Getting GIS up, testing the rather primitive GPS technological units. I mean, this was back before Al Gore turned off the scrambling, you know, it's like...
I know, we think 1999 doesn't seem that long ago, that I didn't realize that GPS was still in its infancy back then for public use.
I should have brought some. So, as I said, I tried to be very careful about documentation and writing up reports, even if it was just a little, activity happened on this in this program, even if it wasn't like, you know, a thing with data analysis, results, conclusions. More like just we collected some data that we hope.
This month we went out on the Chilku Trail and collected plants.
Those were the bi-monthly reports were the activities. And then in addition, I would try to do end of season reports on the various projects and programs going on. And I'm drawing a total blank now.
On any of the projects that you...
Yeah, I know.
Must have some that was like particularly fun or favorite of yours that would come to mind first. You had a plant background. What were you doing with plants?
Well, we did a wetlands mapping project. We did the invasive species. I'm going to get mixed up with all the writing all those PMIS things about what I wanted to do. We were very, very interested in fire history, but I don't think we ever quite got something funded to look at that. Hydromorphology, the Taya River was, you know, of great interest, and it's a meandering glacial river, and there were going to be issues, and understanding the hydrology and geomorphology of it was something high. I think I made a tiny bit of progress, at least got some USGS researchers kind of aware of, but I don't think we ever got got a project going. Maybe Meg did.
Because
I know there's some information out there now.
Glaciers? Any glaciers?
Well, you know, the Norse, up the Norse. So the Tyre River really should be called the Norse River hydrologically. That's
where it comes
from. And up there is, there's some interesting glacier configurations. I would look at maybe the latter part of Meg's tenure and Dave Schirakauer's, because I feel pretty confident they were able to take that issue and get something done with it.
But the fact that you were there at the beginning and had to think of these projects.
Yeah, I was more in the identification.
Yeah. Just remembering back, what were your ideas? What projects did you want to do? So you said, you know, fire history, the hydromorphology,
right.
Other things.
Oh, you name your biological taxon. You know, like, we need to know something about this, the fish and all. The hooligan. They got that finally done.
Hooligan.
They got that ongoing study now with the hooligan.
I'm assuming bears were a popular thing to...
Yeah, that's right. I can remember. I tried to do what I could without being able to actually do a project. So we attempted to get the trail rangers and trail maintenance people, offered them, you know, if you would like to make observations, and this is the kind of stuff that would be very helpful. So with the bears, it's like, you know, there are scratch trees and potentially places where tufts of hair can be left, and of course poop, not to mention just, you know, encounters.
Right.
So we tried to sort of pull that together in an organized manner to start, and I was talking with some bear biologists about doing DNA studies. So the basic problem on the trail is you have, within a week, 5 sightings of a black bear, right? Did they see 5 different bears or 1 bear 5 times?
Right.
You know, just very basic stuff at that level.
But I was thinking, you're at least getting the ranger observations and you know, encounter information, would it least give you an idea from 1 year to the next if there were more or less, if that might tell you something about the size of the bear population? I don't know.
Yeah, it would be, that's where we'd need to get a wildlife biologist specialist in and see what we could do and get advice on, you know, if we really want to get a handle on these population levels, we might need to do something other than just what is opportunistic that we can do along the Chilkoot Trail.
Right.
But there wasn't funding to go there. And if I remember right, we really, really encouraged the bear information so that it wasn't just the trail rangers saying at the end, oh yeah, well, I remember this, I remember that, trying to document it. And then more broadly, having sort of just an environmental reporting system where park staff and hikers, let the hikers in on it too. And it's not a requirement, just if you are interested and you see something you think is interesting, here's a little card to fill out and then start a database on it. I don't know what happened with that. It may have petered out. But especially in this day and age, with more and more emphasis on citizen science and more and more people aware of the concept of citizen science, and the fact that hikers often are a little more in tune with those, you know, I think there is quite an opportunity there. But what about back to like the year 2000? What were we doing? There had to be more. I'm just like totally blanking out.
Well, it does sound like a lot to be managing, and kind of, not that they were all happening, but you say this idea, it sounds like a lot of administrative aspects to the job that you didn't necessarily get to go out in the field yourself very much. Is that accurate?
I got out a fair amount. I tried to make sure I could get out. I had... It was at Assateague Island where I started more into administration, supervision, management versus getting to spend all day out, and it was a difficult transition. So I was already kind of used to that. I was already used to having permanent employees and seasonal employees and volunteers to supervise. So that those things weren't a challenge here.
But you did still try and get out yourself in the field.
I strongly feel like it's not a good idea to have a natural resource manager who's not been personally exposed to the resources. The same, I'm sure, with cultural aspects, archaeological aspects. Maybe once or twice I'd be able to get out on the trail.
A season.
Yeah. It's not like those fun college kids biotechs out there all the time. Yeah, that's I think a transition that everybody in resource management has to deal with.
Yeah, because for a lot of you, the reason you go into those fields is because you do want to be in the outdoors.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
But if you want to be more than a biotech and you feel like you can contribute, that's the transition you have to make.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like you contributed here?
I think so. Yeah, even in that brief time,
things
got more organized. For all the problems with that PMIS system, I left them with, a suite of projects that would potentially get funding and could be sort of picked up and run with. I think we, did we at that time? Yeah, I must have, because I remember working with Carl on it. I think we did update to the resource management program plan. And produced, certainly got the GIS system up and running for all the primitive technology that was there at the time. Got some reports out. Yeah, I think it made a little bit of a nudge in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Sort of set the path for the future that now people are continuing.
Yeah. Enough time has gone by that with that lichen air quality study, the recommendation was do it again in 10 years, and 10 years happened, and that's when Shirakawa was in. Mm-hmm. And he made it happen. He did that next one. And so if it happens again 10 years after that, you start having a pretty nice data set. Yeah.
Well, that's a good example. I was going to ask you about some of the findings from some of these projects. So on that lichen study, what have been the findings?
I can tell you that for the study that I did, I made an effort to do more than simply say, this is what we found at Klondike. And I was able to tap into a Tongass Forest database and a Pacific Northwest database and compare our results to those metrics. And I'm trying to struggle if I had the report. I'm pretty sure that the Pacific Northwest database had established sort of standards, of indications of levels of pollution and stuff. Maybe I'm less clear about the Tongass. But the long and short of it, all this musings that I'm trying to do with my poor old brain, I do remember vividly that for a number of heavy metals, the Klondike samplings came out far above either of those other two databases. So that was enough to get some attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that helped get the support for doing the 10-year later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while. I got a draft of that, and it's been a while since I read it. But I think Dave found that there were still indications, but that as far as lichen, the tool of lichens as the indicator, the levels were drifting down, which would be expected, and is good news. And he started getting more emphasis on actual air sampling the air, as opposed to using the lichen as a proxy for what has happened in the past in the air. And he was also looking at sources and got the city involved a little bit, and I think now the tribe is involved a little bit. So there's been progress. You haven't been here on a summer day with the cruise ships. We get inversions just like you guys do in the winter, and it can be pretty intense.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a pertinent issue to the park and to the community.
And as you, now you being a citizen scientist, have you noticed any impacts from that pollution other than obviously the air quality, but like on the trees or the plants or humans?
No, there would not, I believe, absent the levels of pollution from, say, late 18th century England, where you've probably heard that study where the moths changed because of the air pollution.
No.
Oh, very briefly. That was the era of, spewing coal.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Particulates in the air. And there's a moth species there that has at least two different colors. One is like almost all dark color. The other is this speckled whitish thing. Well, in a healthy environment, the trees all have lichens and bark mosaics, and that mosaic colored one would predominate. But then during that period with the coal air pollution, almost all of them turned to the dark, consistent form. One of the very, very early, we can monitor the environment. And so it wasn't the type of pollution or the level that those broad species, within species morphology changes would happen, or that actual species composition dominance would change. Mm-hmm. But it was more the stuff that had been absorbed by the tissues that would show up. I think it was Meg got the lichen biodiversity thing done, and we only looked at three lichens for that air pollution thing. Well, if you're looking at the broad swath of all of the lichens in the area, there could have been in that mix some that were very sensitive to certain types of pollution, where you might expect that this population would be severely affected. I don't know. I haven't been involved. It's not something that you would notice as, strolling around on your hikes.
Right.
Yeah.
And lichens are studied because they are filtering the air. Maybe you can explain a little bit about why you look at lichen to study air quality.
Yeah, they're great. So especially the ones that aren't growing on the ground, the ones that are growing like on trees, they're essentially getting all their nutrients from the air and rainfall. And then they're very long-lived and they grow slowly. So you end up with a history of not like tree rings where you can say exactly what happened when,
right,
but you know that over the past whatever, few decades, that these plants, well, I shouldn't say plants, these lichens, have been exposed to air and rainfall that had high levels of cadmium, because here it is, high levels of cadmium right there in the tissues.
So you're basically doing chemical analysis to see what those various things were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, things that you notice like right now, I'm going to drift into
climate
change.
Yeah, that's where we're going. Yep.
Okay. So like just walking around right now, and I'm sure if you talk to like the gardeners anybody who's paying attention to the trees and shrubs and plants, is like, oh my goodness, the levels of pest damage are changing dramatically. The preponderance of different kinds of insects are changing very noticeably. Physical things like our poor little glacier that's about gone. Boy, if you talk to Andy Byerly, did that come up?
Okay. Yeah, of course.
Because he's got pictures.
Yes, yeah. Trying to get him to pull those pictures together.
Yeah.
Because it's an amazing thing that he's done.
It's extreme, yeah.
Yeah.
And what, you know. But yeah, for even the casual observer, there are changes happening in the biota that seem linked to climate change, especially since we're all like went around all summer going, God, I can't believe how hot it is. And that was when it was like 78 degrees.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you said that this summer it was hotter and drier.
Yeah. And we do know that that isn't just our subjective experience because, you know, we hear it on the radio and the TV mm-hmm. with the National Weather Service saying, yep, you're right, it's hotter and drier.
Yeah. And so maybe that's, is it too soon to say whether there's a change in the biota because of that?
It is, unless somebody has done the sort of inventory and monitoring program where you could examine those changes. So right now I'm speaking as a layperson right. who's just looking at things. But you would need to have done a distribution and abundance at least a species level. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that has been done or not.
Well, you mentioned that more insects and the pest damage. Do you have some examples of insects that are here now that didn't used to be here?
Yeah, what people are calling woolly bears. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've only been here 20 years, and I'm going, man, I didn't see those for the first 10 years, you know, with the birds. Here, the one thing we do have as a possible reference source is the Bird Club website. Mm-hmm. So as the person who organizes things in the Bird Club, when I hear people at meetings or just talking to them saying, man, there used to be all these crows here, and I'd say, well, do you think we ought to document it? And yeah. And so now there's a page on the Bird Club website about how crows have shifted in the past few decades in Skagway, things like that, how the exotic Eurasian collared dove has become established in the past decade. So there's that level of species change when it's in a sort of in-your-face, macrobiotic kind of doesn't require the level of information that you would need to say the plant species composition in this habitat is shifting. So there's a little bit out there.
Yeah.
Could be more.
And woolly bears, they're those fuzzy caterpillars? Is that what...
Yeah, they're orange and black, and I'm not the greatest insect person, but I understand that technically, they're a tussock moth caterpillar, in that if you were in a different part of the country and people said woolly bear, it would be a different species. That's one nice thing about the bird world is they've standardized their common names. But, well, pretty good.
Really?
Yeah. In the plant world, it's like, the Wild West. And in the insect world, perhaps similar. I'm less familiar with it. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned bats. And toads. I want to go back to those because those are things we tend not to think about very much.
Nothing that was done along those lines when I was in my brief tenure, except that INM was starting, and I was part of a work group that said, "Well, we're Southeast Alaska, man. If there's anywhere where there's more than, one." Toad, this is the place, and we should at least make an effort to be open to gathering information on that. And we came up with sort of this little field flip book saying that these are what we think could be out there, and here's a picture and a description if you see it, But the one that's here for sure, I'm not sure who started it. It was probably either Meg or Dave, but somebody started monitoring for it, and especially where are they reproducing, and I believe that's been going on pretty strong, at least I'm going to say at least 4 or 5 years,
because I think of toads, amphibians, aren't they sort of canary in the coal mine for climate change in some places?
And there's that whole fungus problem. And I'm sure that they've been open to looking for signs of that here. But When you don't have much species diversity, maybe you don't have any species diversity, you can't look at shifts in species composition. When you don't know too much about population dynamics, you can't look at that. But what they have been collecting, at least in the area that they've had access to, which basically is the Dai, lower area of Dai, they'll have now, again, shifting baselines, they'll have at least an idea of what conditions were like starting a few years back to compare to. If new species show up and they have documented, it's always much harder to document not presence of something.
Right.
You know, maybe you just didn't look in the right place. But, I mean, even as far back as when I was here and encouraging trail rangers and trail maintenance people, you know, if you see something that looks like a salamander, tell us. You know, if you see anything up on the trail that looks like a toad or a frog. But anything sort of systematic other than that examination of the toads and Dai, I'm not aware of that, if it exists.
Mm-hmm.
But if it warms up real fast and all of a sudden they see, again, in your face changes of like in Skagway and Dai, people in their gardens start saying, oh, we're seeing this salamander or something. Well, that'll be a big major shift.
Yeah.
Akin to Eurasian collared doves becoming established.
Are there any other new species of birds that you've seen? As you say, you know, you notice something that you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Since you've been here?
One of the other things the bird club has attempted to do is to do a checklist for Skagway. And I think the park, one of the early things Meg tried to do also was a checklist for the park. Well, it quickly became apparent to us that, you know, it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
And Meg would come to the bird club meetings and we would try to work together, but we ended up putting out sort of two versions of the checklist. And I believe perhaps Jamie maybe said something about, both of them are woefully out of date, although on the Bird Club website, we've attempted to at least keep track of the new sightings. But I think Jamie put in there for the park to work with the Bird Club together to update the checklist for both of us.
Well, is it also out of date that there are things that used to come that now aren't here anymore?
Good question. Don't know. So if it's a checklist, you don't have information on distribution and abundance or even presence now. It's that presence has been documented in the past. So you would need something more like a coastal water bird monitoring program, you know, so they're doing good.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I don't want to make assumptions, but definitely things, the obvious, we've been able to document the obvious things visible at the level of the, you know, the, even the casual birders who just look at their bird feeder in their backyard.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and some fairly significant things. I mean, the big thing about the Eurasian collared doves is not so much that they're an exotic that showed up. Starlings have showed up. Other things have showed up. But they have made it through the winter and established breeding here. So, you know, but we got that documented now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, is the assumption because the winters are more mild and that they can survive?
That's certainly a reasonable assumption. So in my brief 20 years, I can tell that the winters are milder. Then you talk to somebody like Andrew or some of the other older folks in town, you know, in their 80s, and, or even the guys that aren't that old that have been here like 40 or years or so, and they'll tell you things, winters used to be very different. So just in my brief 20 years, the first 5 years or so, every winter I would ski up the frozen Tai River. I would go up to frozen Lower Dewey Lake and ice skate if conditions were right. I wouldn't dream of doing that now. You know, even if there seemed like there was safe ice, it's just different.
So yeah. Can you think of when that change might have happened?
Well, it's one of those things, like, it takes you a while. It's not so discreet and dynamic. So you go along and say, skiing up the Taya, frozen Taya, and then, well, I just didn't do it this winter. Maybe I didn't get around to it, or so I don't really know what the conditions are like.
Right.
But then, you know, I tried to go do it, and I was like, ah, no, look at that running water, and it's too dicey, and I'm not doing it. I don't think it's safe. So is it just one winter?
Right.
Is it, you know, so maybe then it's cold again the next winter. But at some point you realize, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
What about kind of where the snow line is? How far up into the mountains do you have to go to get good skiing anymore?
Well, we go up to the pass for that kind of skiing. But in the early years of mine, so as recently as 15, 20 years ago, there would be plenty of times in the winter where we could ski out Denver tracks, where we could go to Dyea and ski around there, because there was enough of a snowpack and it was of good condition. It doesn't happen so much anymore. I don't know that it's happened at all in the past couple of winters.
Yeah, so now you have to go up to the mountains.
Well, people would always go up to the mountains for the really good skiing. You know, and that's, if you talk to, there's a ski club that does Log Cabin. You've probably already heard about them. Mm-hmm. I believe they're saying that, well, it takes longer for the conditions to develop and it takes a little more management on their part. But I don't want to put words in their mouth.
Right.
I should not. But I believe I've heard things along those lines. For me, with 20 years of history, if I compare the first few years to the past few years, I go, wow, it's a big difference. I'd be hard-pressed to say exactly when I maybe had noticed or come to the conclusion that it's not just, you know, a little variation in the system, that it's a change.
And so what are some of the differences? It's warmer in the winters, less snow?
So the scientist in me doesn't want to answer that question.
Okay.
It's like the Weather Service certainly has information on that.
Right.
The park used to, that's another thing we used to do, is there was a snow monitoring station up Klondike Highway that we would go check for snow depth and stuff like that. The records of that should be around. It is where they are now building the new bridge.
I haven't been up there.
So there's a gorge with a half suspension bridge that needs to be replaced, and they're constructing a new bridge.
Okay.
Well, right at the edge of that construction area is where that snow monitoring station was. So it exists no more.
Right.
But then on the other hand, now things are more automated and there is a remote weather station at the pass that the state is running. So there's other sources of information. But
well, you just said you've seen changes. So I'm like, well, what kind of changes?
Well, my impression is that when we do get snow, it tends to be around briefly and then we will thaw. So we have more freeze-thaw cycles, whereas in my earlier years, the snow would come down and get packed on the roads. We'd be driving on, you know, the packed snow ice layer for months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, you know, maybe a week or two, and then it's thawed again. And the town has a ice rink by the rec center that used to strap on the ice skates. I mean, even me, little girl from Georgia who knew nothing about it. I would go, try to ice skate up there. And there was a nice warming station. I don't think they've been able to get ice on the ice rink the past few years, not even once.
Hmm.
So, you know, that level of change is happening.
Well, and those are good examples of, you know, you have example indicators of something that's different than what it was before.
I would wager that if you talk to the big-time gardeners, that they would have some really good information about.
Yeah. You're not a gardener?
I'm a small-time gardener, very, very small-time. But the ones who are very into it, everything from jewel gardens, where it's been formal, to Kim Burnham has a Skagway organic gardening group that she organizes. She's another organizer, so she's great for that kind of stuff. They, within that group, I am sure, have a lot of knowledge in their heads about, this season is shorter, longer, different.
Because last freeze and first freeze, you know, that planting season makes a big difference for them, mm-hmm. whether you're planting in May or June.
Right. So the length, the degree days, all that. The first few years I was here, my partner and I really enjoyed going over to the mouth of the Skagway River during the Hooligan Run and seeing it just black. That's when he was into fishing, and he had this sort of basket on the end of a long pole, and he just scoop up the Hooligan. And then we would hear stories about people coming from Hoonah in their boats and just filling them up with Hooligan. Yeah. There are no Hooligan in the Skagway River anymore. The park has got that Hooligan monitoring thing going on in the Taya, which is excellent.
Any sense of what's changed, why they're not in the Skagway River anymore?
There's, at least from my level of knowledge, there is no way I could even make any good guesses. I mean, there's so many factors going on. What's going on out there before they come in? What's the habitat doing here? We still got the glacial rebound far exceeding sea level rise here. So every year things are a little higher in relation to sea level.
Meaning the ground is... The ground shoreline, is rising. The mainland, okay.
Yeah, so there's the crust of the earth is still responding to the removal of the weight of the last ice age. So every year, it's like, I don't know, it's close to 3/4 of an inch a year higher.
Oh.
That adds up pretty darn fast. Right. So habitats are changing fast.
Right.
And in a shallow river system like the Skagway, the changes could be felt more quickly than a large river system like the Taya. But then what's happening out there in the fjord and in the ocean? And I mean, there are just so many factors. What's happening with the, water temperature, water salinity, water acidity?
Is that being studied? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I doubt it. I would wager that the parks project with the Hooligan is maybe the only thing going on. As a former shrimper, so I had a little boat for a while and would go catch shrimp, we would ask the state over and over again, please do population studies on the shrimp, blah, 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 blah. There's not really a strong commercial fishing industry here.
Right.
The subsistence, local stuff that goes on isn't important enough. There's a huge dearth of information on those sorts of aquatic resources.
When you mentioned invasive species earlier, mm-hmm. so I'm going to take us back. I'm assuming we're talking plant species.
Mm-hmm. And birds.
And birds.
But primarily plants at the time. When I was at the park, we weren't able to start anything on the insects. But there's obviously changes happening there, and maybe they have some baseline data.
What can you talk about what you've noticed in terms of invasive plants? What's come around that's different than it used to be?
Yeah, well, all right, here's an obvious example is the airstrip over there used to be a little tiny gravel strip. And so when they had the big project to make it bigger and paved and put a fence around it, so, like it's protected, they brought in I guess, fill from somewhere, and it had a white sweet clover in it. So that started exploding and was spreading around town, and I will give Meg Haar credit for this, rallying people, the Park Service as the spearhead, but getting the community involved in big weed pulls and keeping that one from taking off, and I think she was very successful. But there's plenty of others. You could argue, and I will as a plant ecologist, that just because it's exotic, if it's not invasive and potentially community structure reorganizing, that maybe it doesn't make sense to put too much effort into this thing. It depends upon what your goals are. But that sweet white clover was big and bold and obvious and had all those characteristics. And because of the park and her efforts, it is not the problem it could have turned into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say invasive becomes a problem when it's going to take over the natural plant community and wipe out
and
the...
And alter it. Yeah.
So are there other ones that have come in and done that?
What I was trying to express this just then is kind of the same thing we were talking about before. Some changes are obvious to us humans on our scale of people just sort of noticing things. Mm-hmm. But then there are definitely changes that happen that are difficult for us to discern if we don't look at them in a systematic way. So the white sweet clover was at that human level,
right,
easy to see change. There could be other things going on, and there are definitely some candidates, but it would be at a different level. And so you would need to show that it's happening, that it's having an impact, and exactly what kind of an impact. Usually it's like habitat for some desirable animal species is the key to getting any sort of buy-in that there should be some action taken. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would venture to say, again, this, I'm sure the park has done some work on this, at least a good dozen species. I think they started working with the tribe, the Skagway Traditional Council, and mm-hmm. they've been putting out sort of like an annual flyer through the post office saying, look out for at least, you know, this six or seven species,
right,
and if you see it, pull it up. But as for impacts and whether a huge effort should be made, I'm not aware of that sort of information being looked at.
Well, and as you say, a gardener might find a new plant that in their garden is a weed, and they might find it offensive,
mm-hmm.
but is that enough to consider it an invasive plant?
Probably not. And not on a, you know, ecosystem habitat level. Annoying gardeners is a whole different thing. Because a lot of plants that are very adapted to their environment and what would be considered native components if they get in your garden or a weed.
Right.
So, you know.
Right. But again, it's the same question of, well, if the temperatures are warming here, you know, it's warmer in the winter and is it drier in the summer, does that create a habitat that different plants can take mm-hmm. hold than they used to be able to? Maybe they were brought in as a seed on the train, but they would die out, and now they're mm-hmm. surviving.
Excellent. You should be in the business.
Are there examples of those?
Probably.
Oh, okay. I figure you're the plant ecologist. You're going to give me all these examples.
Yeah, you would think. I haven't been in that business since I left the park.
Yeah.
So part of the reason why I got so involved with birds is the community level interest in birds was very high.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have been successful trying to get people together for a botany club.
No,
you know. The bird club, the organic gardening club, John McDermott has the Skagway Naturally Facebook page, and he's been very successful in getting people in the community interested in reporting just any flora, fauna, any sort of wildlife sightings that they find of interest, or I see this weird plant or bug. You know, it's the Facebook thing.
Right.
I'm not a big Facebook person.
Right.
So, but I try to do a little cross information exchange between that group and the bird club group. And at some point, these citizen science things, I believe, will develop to the point where they become the primary repository of information. Are you familiar with eBird at all?
Mm-mm.
So eBird is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's effort to get all those thousands of birders. When you know how birders can
yes,
be,
yes.
They can be pretty, OCD about the whole thing. Well, let's take advantage of all that. And so they've got this eBird system where you can enter your observations.
Oh.
And wait another 10 years. So if the park wants to monitor something with the birds and they send somebody out to look in a systematic way every 2 weeks, that's great. And that's a certain quality of data that is gold. On the other hand, if you have dozens of people who are birders every day willing to say, this is what I saw this day, that's a different kind of data that has a broader coverage, is maybe more variable in its quality, but a different kind of data that is also gold.
Right.
And that's the direction that is moving. And we're already seeing it in Skagway, in that in the summer months, all those cruise ship visitors, well, there's a bunch of them that are birders.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look on eBird, you see a lot of entries for Skagway in the summer.
Oh, interesting. So it sounds like you think that the Park Service is becoming more receptive to utilizing citizen science information and collaborating.
I think so. Yeah. It doesn't make sense to exclude yourself from it. It also doesn't make sense to depend only on that.
Right.
Because you would be limited in the scope of questions that you could answer.
But it sounds like when you first started with the Park Service, and then certainly in the Teresa days, there was not that interest.
Those citizen science things didn't
exist.
Didn't
exist yet. Yeah.
So it's an interesting shift, and I think it will greatly help the Park Service at a park like this where there are lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And not going to help, Bering Land Bridge. So
right.
Much. Maybe a little bit.
I think, what do you suspect has behind that shift? Like, why are people more interested?
The whole confluence of internet communications, smartphones, apps making things easy, combined with even the many birders who are very, very detail oriented, to the casual birders who still know enough to contribute what they see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, if people in Skagway, do you think they're noticing things more and more aware than they used to be, and so they're getting involved in this kind of citizen science?
Oh, yeah, well, eBird's not working so good for Skagway.
Right.
The bird club. The reason, do you really want to go here? The reason being that when eBird was set up, they took on the political boundaries as their sort of base area unit. That meant counties at the county level,
right,
in most states. So in Alaska, it meant the borough level. And at that time, it was just like, missed it by a year or two, was when Alaska was trying to make the effort to boroughize you remember that? And at the time when they set it up, Skagway was without borough. And so we got lumped into a geographic area with Gustavus, Hoona, and Goon, I think Pelican, basically places pretty far away and in extraordinarily different birding habitats. So there is no tool within eBird right now to give the Skagway birders that are in the bird club, the reward for entering their data into eBird, other than just what I have seen myself personally.
Right.
There's no, you can't say what has been seen in Skagway for the past week. What you get is, you know, pelagic birds from Huna.
Right.
So there's some issues there, but I'm sure over the next decade, you know, some of those things will be worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the progression of those things such that it will become more and more of a source of information that the park will have at its disposal to help with understanding what's going on
mm-hmm.
with the environment here. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you quickly about was the seabird die-off.
Yeah.
That I have an article about, and Joanne mentioned it. So I guess that was in 2016?
We've had a couple of them. They're documented on the webpage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a bizarre time. And turned out to be part of this, you'd have to say, northern eastern Pacific wide phenomenon that is... The documentation for it is being coordinated in two places that I'm aware of. One is the COAST program, COASST, out of Oregon, I believe. And the other is the Alaska USGS office in Anchorage, I think. Handel Christmas. Colleen Handel is, I believe, the contact person there. So when we start seeing an unusual bird for us, a common murre, and then plus acting weird and dying all over the place. You know, we try to deal with it here and document it, and then we're like, well, people need to know about this, and we got in touch with both of those entities to pass it on. And since that time, we are now integrated. We have integrated into the COAST COASST
mm-hmm.
Program with two beaches in Skagway being monitored for dead bird events through the bird club.
So those two that you mentioned, those are the only two in your 20 years that you remember such large bird die-offs?
Yes. Yeah.
And
but see, there's the wealth of information in people's brains right now. So, you know, if Stan Selmer, B. Lingle, you talk to the Byerleys, Betsy Albecker, she's been aware of birds. I mean, these people have so much, I mean, they got the 40 or 50 or 60 year memories to deal with. And I feel like, you know, they're more important to talk to.
Well, I am talking to them, but okay. I'm also talking to you. You know, one, it's a 20-year, is still a significant time. And as a scientist, you come from a slightly different perspective. Okay. So it's interesting to hear your side. So you're an ecologist, scientist, but you're also somebody who's out and about and you have observation skills, so you're kind of the combo.
Okay, I'm comforted to know that those names sound familiar you're going to... Okay, great.
Yeah.
Great.
I hadn't realized before, you know, getting into this project that myrrh die-off had hit way down here. You know, I heard about it up in the Bering Sea in that part of Alaska, but...
Mm-hmm. We'll never have the quantities that other places experience for these events. We don't have the biodiversity here or abundance. I mean, it's a dramatic difference to go to Gustavus from here and the amount of just life. And you know, here we are, we're at the end of a long fjord, you know. But to me, that makes it even more important to understand what's happening here. So when you're on the fringe of habitat acceptability, changes might show up that you can discern that you won't perhaps see in places where there's, you know, 20,000 shorebirds coming through instead of, you know, tens or hundreds.
Yeah, I didn't even know common murres came through here, so
Not usually.
Not usually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was going on?
So that's an excellent thing. So we know from the parks efforts and the bird club's efforts to start documenting and have it be something more than, oh, well, we've talked to two or three older people and they say they don't remember seeing that bird hanging around. To have something a little beyond that level. And because of that, we know that when those MERS showed up, that at least for X number of years prior to that, no, we documented that they were not seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically is the Coast Oregon program's goal, is, you know, to document that something isn't there, dead birds on the beach, even if it's for years, so that when something does happen, you can say this is an unusual event. And if it's linked to a pollution incident, and it gets into the court system,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how many birders say, I don't remember, but if you have data that says we went out and specifically looked and here's the database, and they were not, you know, you can't make the argument, well, you know, you can't say those birds died in association with our incident because you don't know, they might have been doing that before.
Right.
So it's a combination of all these different levels of citizen science, local and broader, park-sponsored stuff, and then participating. And this is something that I think is important at the park level to understand, that participation in statewide and nationwide and continent-wide efforts as a data contributor is maybe, well, certainly just as important, maybe in some ways more important than, you know, just doing park-specific projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the MERS die-off, you guys took some of those and had them sampled to see that it wasn't pollution or contamination or
right.
something?
We had, and it's on the website. I think we sent two or three carcasses down through the Fish and Wildlife Service. The person in Juneau at the time, her name is Deb Rudis, also happens to be the person who has been doing the breeding bird and the Alaska land bird monitoring for us since my time. Her job, I won't get it exactly right, but she had to do with, I think, endocrine disruptor chemicals in the environment. Anyway, she knew how to get those birds to the Fish and Wildlife Service lab that analyzes dead stuff to try to figure out why it died. And the only information we got back really was that the immediate cause of death was starvation. Now, why are they starving?
Right.
I believe, I would have to double check, I believe we did get a little trickle of information that sort of the big obvious chemical contaminants and toxins that could be responsible were not found. But then there's the more subtle ones, and, you know, and then it starts playing into the whole changes in the northern Pacific with the blob
right.
and everything else, and the food they think now is going down deeper than the diving birds can dive.
Okay.
So that whole thing is it's a part of the picture.
Right. Yeah. And the blob makes me think about plastics in the ocean.
Oh, different blob.
I know, but so where my brain's going is the plastics, which it makes me think about things that wash up here on the beach, and if you've noticed changes in that, whether it's animals, you know, washing up versus plastic washing up. I don't know if you go out there and notice those things.
Well, I'm one of the coasters. So me and Nicole over at the Watershed Council, we're sharing the Naku Bay Beach. So one of us goes out there once a month to document what's there. Joanne and Deb Betcher are doing, I think, Skagway Harbor. Or is it the mouth of the Skagway? They got one they're doing here in town.
Mm-hmm.
Coast also has a marine debris monitoring, but it's very intensive. I believe that maybe Deb and Joanne started doing it, but then had to let it go. There have been various cleanup days. I do not know if they're part of documentation or if it's just get it off the beach.
So when you've been out on your beach, you know, that you're taking over, what have you seen out there?
Lots of plastic. Yeah. But, you know, I'm somewhat jaded. So as I mentioned earlier, I started at Eastern Coastal Parks.
Right.
And participated in a very involved way with documenting trash on the beaches, primarily plastics, and programs there. By the time I got here, and it's going on, I'm not interested anymore in spending the time to pick up pieces of plastic and catalog them. That's a personal thing,
right?
You know, I am interested in advocating for changes to our trash management and our whole economic system to try to make it less pollution. So that's where I'm putting my efforts now.
So are there efforts in Skagway to make some of those changes?
Oh, goodness, yes. The whole waste management stream right now is being reexamined, and there's a... Kim Burnham is involved, but primarily her husband, Steve Burnham, is a prime mover in, you know, let's try to change the way this town manages our solid waste. And they've been having lots of work groups and meetings and stuff, and I've gone to a few of them, and I know I like the direction they're going, but I don't know the details. But they were looking at, you know, creating a solid waste facility, pulling out the organic stream and composting it. Right now it's all mixed up together and taken up to our incinerator, and putting all this wet, heavy organic stuff into an incinerator is maybe, you know, not the best. So it's that there's interest in the town, there's efforts being made, things could change.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was like kind of one of my final questions is, yeah, in the community, have you noticed a change in the conversations? Are people talking more about climate change and responses to environmental issues?
Everybody talks about the weather. Everybody talks about, I mean, there's the little glacier, our little glacier. Every day we see it, and we're like, tiny, it's disappearing.
And that's the one up on Harding Mountain?
Yeah. People will, on those inversion days, they'll talk about the visible air pollution. But then you start, you know, it's like people start having more focused interests. So the gardeners, the hikers, the birders, you know. But the winter recreation people, yeah. Everybody has their own spheres of awareness. And I would venture to say that it's coming up all over.
Yeah. So it is a topic of concern for people that things are
changing.
It's
a topic of conversation. Now, when you get down to concern, you would have to start talking to people. And I usually don't go there. I'm usually more interested with, what'd you notice?
Right.
But then concern would be, I'm sure there's plenty of people who think it's part of natural variation, and that there's other people who think it's signs of climate change. And there's probably a whole range of levels of concern. And I would not claim to have a finger on the pulse of what that is.
But it's not like it's become such a level of concern as in some communities of Alaska where, you know, our village is eroding into the river or you know, we have to start moving things.
Definitely,
you know, changing infrastructure, that it hasn't gotten to that level here.
No, not likely. Not as long as our glacial rebound is quicker than sea level rise.
Yeah. So people talk about it, but it hasn't gotten to be a threat yet to change
not
lifestyles.
That kind of, Well, lifestyles are maybe is affecting a little bit. I would say my lifestyle has been affected. I mean, as far as winter recreation mm-hmm. and stuff. Livelihoods, probably not. Far greater impacts are things like, you know, no more hatchery salmon and stuff like that. An argument could be made that there might be more opportunities for tourism. I know the cruise ships keep pushing the shoulder seasons, and if people can offer excursions and stuff, so, you know, in that sense, it might be considered a benefit.
Yeah, I thought about that, a longer tour season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'd say it's kind of a mixed bag. But there's not existential threats, and that's because of our glacial rebound. Mm-hmm. The last forest fire happened just before I got here in 98, and they got on it pretty quick. The brief investigations I did of the fire ecology here, there's definitely signs of fire-adapted plants in the communities, not fire-dependent, but fire-adapted. Being here on the ecotone between the boreal interior and having, what is it now, 24 inches average rain? I think when I got here it was like 26 inches, so it's kind of drifting. But the point being, the conditions probably for a long time have always been a little more conducive to having fire be part of the system. And that could be changing. And if that changed drastically, maybe that would be more of an existential threat. Not existential. It would be, you know, something that would cause extensive damage, perhaps, right. and require response.
But it's interesting that there has been a history of wildfires here, but since you've been here, they haven't really been a factor.
That when I hit the ground, that one right. had just happened.
Right, but since then?
I don't recall any significant wildfires since then.
And as you know, I think of southeastern Alaska, it's wet. You know, you wouldn't have a history of wildfires here.
Well, we're right on
but
the edge.
But you're right on the edge here.
Right on the edge.
So what are those adaptive species? And the fire-dependent are the kinds, like the
like
trees that they have to have the fire to release their seeds from the cones.
Right, right.
Which we don't have here, I guess. But what would be an example of a fire-adaptive species?
Trees that do much better establishing themselves after a burn. Their seeds and saplings are significantly, substantially more likely to survive that sort of thing. You look at the plant community structure here, and what is Haines, 15 miles away? It's just so dramatically different. And so there are these plants that can survive and thrive in drier conditions with the occasional burn. I know I used to talk to Carl a lot about, you know, records of fire from the Gold Rush mm-hmm. on, and certainly there were, and records of tree cutting and stuff like that. And then I started hiking around and looking for things like char layers in the ground and stuff. Found enough evidence to say, well, this is something we should look into and study, and wasn't able to get anything funded.
Right.
I'm not sure if anything has been funded. But you look at the mosaics of different trees, and you go, well, that easily could be. That could have burned like 100 years ago, and that's why we're seeing this patch of, broadleafs and
like cottonwoods or something, or birch.
There's indications worth investigating.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, that's like with geomorphology, like when you see boulders in strange places, you know, you're like, oh, that's worth investigating.
Yeah.
So I would say that
that needs to be done. It would be valuable to have that be done and understand it more, because if things continue to get drier and hotter, then you would expect naturally the chances of those events happening more frequently.
Right.
If ecologically we're in this interglacial period, you know, if evidence can be found that ecologically they used to happen every 500 to 1,000 years, and they start happening every 30 years, you know, but or 40 years or 50 years. The problem is 50 years is getting close to a human lifespan, right. And you might not notice unless you look hard.
Right.
So I think, yeah, there are indications and would be valuable to investigate.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, with, you know, climate change being such a global topic, that does that contribute to people on the local level paying attention more and looking and seeing those things? Not that they're seeing the change, but as you say, are they starting to observe and notice more?
Certainly, I'm sure many people are. At the community level, I don't know. When you get into those, what are people thinking and what are their motivations?
Right.
I'm just...
No, it was sort of an abstract question.
Yeah.
You know, that's possible that because now this awareness, mm-hmm. education and awareness, then makes people start to notice things that maybe they didn't notice before.
Right.
And so, as you said, you know, is it something that's happened all this time and nobody noticed, or is it really a change? And that is a hard thing to determine.
Right.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. Are there any other things that you wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you about or that have come to mind along the way?
Nothing immediately comes to mind. I would say definitely look at the Bird Club website for some of this documentation. And if, you know, I can dig up some old reports if you need more information about any of those topics. And I'm just very grateful that you're talking to a lot of the older folks who aren't immediately associated with the Park Service about some of these things. It's hard to find somebody in this town who hasn't had some involvement with the Park Service.
Right. And some of it's good, some of it's not good. So, well, thanks. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.